You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Gun safety, new banking regulations, unaccounted for government spending. There is never a shortage of issues being debated and discussed on Capitol Hill. With us now to talk about a few of them is Senator Gary Peters. Senator Peters, welcome back to Stateside.
That's great to be with you.
Let's start with this morning's news. The Trump administration is rolling out its plan to respond to violence and guns in our schools. It wants to provide firearms training to some teachers, so arming teachers, but backs off making major changes to gun laws. So there's nothing about raising the minimum age to buy guns from 18 to 21. And following the mass shooting at Parkland in Florida, the president said he was in favor of raising the minimum age, and that apparently was backed off after he met with the NRA. What do you make of the president's efforts so far responding to school shootings?
Well, I think his response to school shootings is the same response he gives to everything, which means he'll make one statement. A day later, it'll be something different. The third day, it'll be something completely different from the other two. There doesn't seem to be any, you know, any kind of consistency. And whenever he says something, you've got to figure whoever talks to him last will likely have an impact.
And he has set up this Federal Commission on School Safety, chaired by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Do you have confidence in Secretary DeVos and this committee?
I don't know one way or the other. I don't have a whole lot of confidence, though. I certainly would like to hope that there would be some thoughtful ideas and comprehensive ideas and not based on politics or the agenda of the NRA. But it's hard to know. It's really hard to know. I think what we have to do is focus on things that the vast majority of the American people want. And one of those things is that we should have comprehensive background checks. It is something that everybody in this country seems to agree on, that before you purchase a weapon, you should go through a background check. Currently, because of the loopholes with gun shows and buying online, 40% of all guns are sold without any kind of background check. 40%. That makes no sense whatsoever. And when you look at the gun violence every single day, and this is the other thing that I think it's very important to remember, and as tragic as the incident was in Florida and 17 lives were lost, we have to remember that every single day, roughly 90 people die of gun violence. Every single day. Every month, 50 women die of domestic violence with a weapon. These are huge numbers, and it's happening every single day. And one thing we know that can be effective in reducing those numbers is making sure we have comprehensive background checks. We first have to make sure the system works, and hopefully we can get what they call a fix the NIC, which is the system that puts in the data. But you can't just do that. You've also got to make sure it actually applies to every weapons purchase. And so that's what I'm pushing for, and my colleagues are pushing for. That will make a meaningful step forward. And you know, even if you ask rank-and-file NRA members, I think it's something like 65-70% believe we should do that. 90% of the American people think we should have comprehensive background checks. There are very few issues in this country where 90% of the American people agree.
And yet, you know, a tragedy happens and people turn to Congress and ask the question, what is it going to take to get Congress to actually act and do more than sending thoughts and prayers every time there's a mass shooting?
Well, we have to get the leadership to put it on the table to vote on. And so the Republicans control the House, the Republicans control the Senate, and we have a Republican in the presidency. All we're saying, let's put it on the floor, let's vote. Let's take an up or down vote on comprehensive background checks, and then those folks have to go back to their districts or their states. We've got elections coming up in 2018. They're going to have to defend what they do one way or the other.
Let's move to net neutrality. The FCC has published the final notice of its repeal of net neutrality rules, so the countdown is on to actually repealing it. We're in the final weeks of unrestricted internet. What do you believe lies ahead for Michigan consumers and businesses once net neutrality is gone?
Well, I'm very concerned that you are going to have basically two classes of the internet. The folks who can pay to have much higher speeds, large companies, will be able to dominate a lot of aspects of the internet because they will have the faster highway to the rest of us. That has an impact on individual users. It certainly has a big impact on small businesses as well. You know, part of the beauty of the internet was its equalizing factor is that when you got on the highway of the internet, you all had the same speed. And speed is pretty important in the internet. You know, having access to high speed allows you to connect for the e-commerce. It allows you to access new technologies in telemedicine, which will bring healthcare to people in rural areas. But you need to have net neutrality to make sure everybody has equal access.
And you've joined with other Democrats and at least one Republican in a bill to reverse the FCC ruling using something called the Congressional Review Act, the CRA. What is that?
Well, it allows you to repeal basically an act that goes forward, and then you need a majority vote. So you need 51 votes. We are one vote short in the Senate to do that. So we're putting, having folks call their U.S. senators. No worries here in Michigan. Both of us are on there. But in other states, we're just one vote away.
You've recently unveiled a bipartisan bill to help small farmers. Tell us what this bill would do.
Well, this is a bill to increase the FSA funding, which is federal funding through the Department of Ag to help small farmers with loans. They're guaranteed loans that then go through the local banks, similar to SBA loans for small businesses. They're absolutely critical if you're a small farmer. In fact, I was at a small farm just Friday, Dreamwinds Farm over on the west side of the state. A young farmer who always dreamed of being a farmer now is in business. He started with 30 cows. He now has 250 cows, a great family business that he and his wife run. It would not have happened without these loans, but they're capped currently. And so there's a limited amount. And then when they hit the cap, they stop. And in fact, Paul, who is the owner, talked about how he needs to take out a loan for feed or something to move his operations forward, and then you can't do it, and then you're really in a pickle. So my legislation extends the cap by 25%, or it gives the flexibility. You don't have to increase the cap. It depends on the demand, but it provides additional loans for those smaller farms. And I think it goes to the very heart of what is important to not only Michigan, but to the country, and that's to have family farms. You know, we've got more and more of these corporate farms. It's very difficult to be a family farmer, and yet it's a good living if you have the resources and the capital to start. And it's about who we are as America. Yeah, you know, it harkens back to the days of Thomas Jefferson, who believed that the republic would be safe as long as we had yeoman farmers who owned their piece of America and were independent and were voting. And today we'd call that the American middle class.
And what are the political challenges to getting this bill passed?
Well, it's bipartisan, so I'm working with Dave Perdue, a Republican out of Georgia. We hope to move it forward. We have the support of most all of the major farming organizations have also endorsed it. So we're hoping it may be part of the farm bill that'll eventually move if it can't move on its own. The farm bill has traditionally been a pretty bipartisan piece of legislation, and we hope that it continues to be so.
If you just joined us, we are talking with U.S. Senator Gary Peters, just kind of picking his brain on a variety of issues. Last week, the Senate voted to begin debate on a banking bill that would bring about the first big overhaul of banking regulations since Dodd-Frank was passed in 2010 in response to the financial meltdown. So it would roll back and revise regulations on banks, including raising the threshold set by Dodd-Frank that would trigger stricter oversights by the Federal Reserve. It was $50 billion in assets. The bill raises that to $250 billion in assets. So it would exempt some 20 financial companies. You and Senator Debbie Stabenow were among the 16 Democratic senators who joined with Republicans to advance this bill. Why?
Well, it's basically about smaller banks, too. It's not just raising the threshold. That's one aspect of it. But it's about taking some of the regulations that were added under Dodd-Frank that impact credit unions. The credit unions, for example, are very strong supporters of this legislation. Community banks are small. Small banks in our communities are very supportive. And, you know, I served on the Dodd-Frank Conference Committee. Not only did I support Dodd-Frank, I was on the committee that negotiated the final version. I was placed on there as a freshman, which is very unusual to have a freshman on the conference committee. So I believe very strongly in Dodd-Frank, but it was a very large piece of legislation that you need to go back and tweak, and then particularly when it came to smaller institutions as well as regional banks, which are the ones that you mentioned. You know, what had happened and what I was very concerned about as we went into the financial crisis is that we had seen increased concentration of money in a very few very large banks, and smaller banks were having a harder time to compete. But what has happened since that time and since Dodd-Frank, we've actually had even further concentration. We have bigger and bigger banks that are dominating the marketplace. I do not think that that is healthy. You've got to have a vibrant banking sector with lots of competition. That's the best thing for consumers. Is if you have banks competing for your business, you're going to do a whole lot better than if we end up with just a handful of banks in this country. I think that would be horrible. And so part of that is this legislation is to make sure smaller community banks, credit unions, and regional banks have the flexibility they need to be profitable. And we should always remember that the financial crisis was not caused by your local credit union. It was not caused by a community bank or a regional bank. It was the large Wall Street banks.
Critics say, though, that this bill will still help big banks.
Well, it's simply not accurate. I mean, this is really about regional banks and those below. You know, even Barney Frank, although he said he wouldn't vote for this for obvious reasons because he was the drafter of it, but he also said this is really a pretty small tweak to the act. And he said, actually, that by passing this is like the rework, it actually enshrines the vast majority of Dodd-Frank is now enshrined in law after this bipartisan bill. So I think, you know, that's the way you've got to look at it, is that we've got to be practical. And quite frankly, you know, if you're a large Wall Street bank, you want strict regulations on yourself and everybody else, because you know that you can now hire all the people to handle all of that regulation. But if you're a small bank, it is incredibly expensive. And it's why, quite frankly, a lot of community banks here in Michigan, 20% of community banks have gone out of business since the financial crisis. And they have a very large regulatory burden, which raises their cost disproportionate to those of the very large banks that can absorb it. So if you have a candid conversation with Wall Street Bank, they'll tell you they like regulations because it gives them a competitive advantage. And we can't give them a competitive advantage, so we only have 5 large banks in this country. That would be really bad.
The bill certainly seems to have exposed a rift in your party, with a lot of Democrats asking, have you forgotten what the banks did to cause the crash that hurt Michigan so deeply? Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown said you and others who support the rollback are suffering from collective amnesia. What do you say to them?
I will say, and of course I have the highest respect for Sherrod, he is a wonderful senator and a colleague of mine, is that I don't have amnesia. I remember very vividly that credit unions did not cause the crisis. I remember very vividly that small community banks didn't cause the crisis, or regional banks. It was really large Wall Street banks that was engaged in very speculative derivatives activities. You know, it was derivatives that leveraged what was a risky situation, but by many, many times. When it comes to derivatives regulation, that's still part of Dodd-Frank. Those are enshrined, and that will not be changed by this legislation.
Currently underway is the first ever full audit of the Pentagon, and so far it's not going very well. In February, Politico reported the accounting firm Ernst & Young found the Defense Logistics Agency failed to properly document more than $800 million in construction projects alone. As a member of the Armed Services Committee and the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Federal Spending Oversight, what are your thoughts on how that Defense Department audit's going so far?
Not well. It's not going well at all. It's really proving what I have always been concerned about and have asked that we need to have a full and complete audit of the Department of Defense, which is starting to go through. It's not complete. But just the Defense Logistics Agency, which I think you're referencing there, is very concerning, that you have an organization spending hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars over a period of time, and you can't fully account for it. It's simply unacceptable. So we're going to be continuing to push that. As you mentioned, I'm the ranking member on the federal spending oversight. So we look at a wide range of federal spending, but we've got to really focus on the Department of Defense. It's a large budget item. National defense is important. We want to make sure that they get the funding that they need, but they have to be accountable to the taxpayers that you're actually spending it wisely. And, you know, one area that I'm particularly concerned about with that is just the procurement system, is when we procure weapon systems that are vitally important, and we're going to have a whole slew of new ones coming on board, but they always seem to have cost overruns and then more cost overruns. We've got to stop that. That's simply unacceptable.
Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said keeping track of the people's money may not be in the Pentagon's DNA. How do you feel?
Well, we got to change that.
What would you do to you know, tighten oversight of Pentagon spending? How should it be changed?
Well, first off, is this audit process. You know, this didn't happen before. I'm just at a loss for words as to why we haven't been doing this all along. You know, any business does audits. I know when I was running my offices in the private sector, you always prepared for audits, and when you got your audit reports, you had to fix those audit problems. And if you did really well, you got a bonus. So it was, you had an incentive to make sure you could actually account for every single penny. And And certainly the company demanded that, and we should demand nothing less of the Department of Defense as taxpayers. And certainly we need to do that all across all levels of government and in every single agency. But the Department of Defense has a notorious history of not keeping track the way they should.
I want to talk about reaction to the head-spinning daily flood of headlines that pour out of the White House. Payoff money to an adult film actress, serious questions about Jared Kushner and the president's sons mixing personal business with government business, the president's refusal to impose the sanctions that Congress voted to slap on Russia for meddling with our election. I'm going to stop there. There's so much more. And yet, silence from Mitch McConnell, from Paul Ryan, from most every Republican except perhaps Jeff Flake. When you talk with your Republican colleagues, you're away from the cameras, you're away from the microphones. What do you hear from them? How are they responding to this?
Well, I don't think they're pleased with it, and they certainly are very tired of trying to constantly explain it away because there really is no good explanation for it. But it still frustrates me that if they say that in private, I don't know why they're not stepping up publicly. We expect folks to be in Congress. You know, our founders, the framers of the Constitution, believe that the Congress would be a check on the executive, and that's just not happening. And, you know, I suppose it may not happen until they believe that supporting President Trump is detrimental to their political future. And hopefully that will become apparent in the elections in 2018.
Senator Gary Peters, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
Great to be with you, as always.